When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to So Very Wrong About Games. This is a gaming podcast about board games. We're going to talk about board games. First, we're going to talk about the game we reviewed roughly 1 year ago. Then we're going to talk about all of the games we played last week. Then we're going to talk about some news, very short, brief news segment this week, and why it totally doesn't matter. And then we're going to do a Q&A. We've asked our listeners to send us questions on all sorts of the clickety-clacks, social media code.
This is why we call it the Omnibus Questions. We do this every couple years or so. I looked it up. Actually, the last time we did this, this is our fourth. When we did our third was actually May 2 years ago.
Wow.
So we do this intermittently. This is kind of our mailbag episode. We felt it was time, and we're going to be doing Omnibus Questions Delta Aleph, because this is going to be the first of a two-part, because we got a lot of good questions. I'm interested to get to a lot of them.
I think last time we did a two-part.
We did a two-part last time as well. This is because our listeners are an inquisitive lot, and we are more than happy to help them out. By the way, I'm your co-host, Mark Bickney.
And with me, Mark.
Hey, Mark.
How's it going?
It's going very well. And with me is Michael Walker.
Hey. That's me.
Hey, Michael. So, Walker, what did we review last year?
Mosaic, A Story of Civilization.
This is by Glenn Drover. It was a review copy we got from the publisher Forbidden Games. They ran a successful Kickstarter for a tableau-building civilization-type game.
And we've played it a lot since.
We have.
An expansion came out with it.
Wars and Disasters.
We enjoy a lot of it, but not all of the expansion. But
yes,
we enjoy almost all of Mosaic itself.
Yes, the core game itself is very good, I think, at doing what it sets out to do. If you're expecting a traditional Civ-like experience, if you look at the troops, be they cardboard or plastic, depending on the edition you have, and expect it to feel like a troops on a map game, you're going to be very sorely disappointed. If you even expect the same level of direct military engagement that you might find in, for example, Through the Ages, A Story of Civilization, I think you will also be somewhat disappointed, because the military buildup in Through the Ages is a necessity. Military buildup in Mosaic is just another way to get at every majority, broadly speaking.
Yeah, I don't even want to compare it to El Grande, because not even that.
Yeah, exactly. So it is one of my favorite tableau builders of the past few years. It's primarily about buying the new toys and getting the right symbols out and having a tableau with enough of a civilization veneer to make me happy. And Glenn Drover is a designer who has done a number of works that we very much enjoy. His worker placement sort of kind of Age of Empires thing, which has gone under a number of different titles. We like his Railroad Tycoon, we meaning mostly Walker. I very much like Raccoon Tycoon, but he's also done a bunch of stuff that we don't like. So Mosaic is squarely in the stuff that we do like, and I'm very pleased to have it. And as Walker said, it comes back to the table with a fair degree of regularity. It's just easy to play. It's an easy playing game. The flow is real, as Walker would say, and there's lots of cool stuff to see and do. So very pleasing.
As far as I'm concerned, the only drawback is that there's so many sort of parameters or sort of
scoring conditions
to hit.
Yes.
And so you're constantly just checking to make sure people haven't forgotten them or you haven't forgotten them.
It's true. Has anyone gotten to 6 coins? No one's gotten to 6 coins. Oh, I'm at 8 coins. Like, well, you should score the 6 coins, Achievo.
Yeah.
Precisely. I agree. So that is Mosaic, A Story of Civilization by Glenn Drover, published by Forbidden Games. I think it is pretty perennially in my collection and will stay there. So, Walker, now on to the games we played last week. What'd you play last week?
Mark, I played Gloomhaven Button and Bugs. This is a solo game designed by Kip Fell and Necky Valens, put out by Cephalofair Games. And it's sort of like a shorter version, a totally abridged, like abridged
to not really a bridge, sort of like just a jump over the stream of Gloomhaven. And I thought they did a really great job. They really sort of caught what the essence of at least Gloomhaven is for me, and that is choices on what cards to use. It is a great look. You have it like a scenario deck, and it'll read you the story, and then you turn over the last card of that particular story for that scenario, and there's a little mini map, and you put out your little guy, and you put cubes out for the enemies, and then they have these card holders, and they have a card for the enemy and a card for you, and that sort of takes care of like the sort of hit modifier deck.
Yeah, the modifier deck.
You're moving down these tracks, and it takes a little bit of space, but not that much.
Oh, it's a very, very space-efficient game.
Yes. The only change I think I would have made for that would be, I've seen many games that have multiple dials on sort of one piece of cardboard. I think they could have got away with that for all the enemies, just had like one strip of cardboard with a bunch of dials on it, and I think that would have cleaned it up even more. And the rule book could have been a lot clearer, I wish. A little thicker, maybe. I know it was going for a small box. The box is adorable. The dimensions are a scaled down Gloomhaven box almost exactly. So, you know, out of scale, you would think it would be a full Gloomhaven box. Anyway,
frankly, most things about buttons and bugs are adorable.
It's so true. I played the first scenario. There's a good chance I'll go back to play more, and I'm really not a solo person, so that's saying something. Gloomhaven, button and bugs.
You know what, actually, the way I would characterize it, and this is a vibe that I very much like but seldom see in board games, it's cute but it's not cutesy. I love cute but not cutesy. And that's exactly what Gloomhaven Buttons and Bugs is. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
True. I just want to make clear, Mark got a review copy. I backed it on crowdfunding. And hopefully it's going to be available for everyone.
Yeah, and I've been meaning to go back to the campaign. The difficulty has shot up. It was standard kind of thing. The first few scenarios are kind of sort of a tutorial. But even then, they were sufficiently challenging so as to be diverting. And the past few have been really, really hard. So I think I'm at the point where I might just accept the loss but still continue on in the campaign. It's a solo game. Cheating is fine.
It's true.
Or cheating against Walker.
Exactly.
Or cheating with people you don't know. Right? Oh, that's how it works?
I thought it was murdering people you don't know.
No. Uh-oh. I think I... Ooh.
Okay. We have a problem. So, it's a little bit more... I think they go for the puzzle a little bit more than they do in Gloomhaven. It's very much, you know, pushing people into traps and getting the most out of your cards. But the way they cycle the cards, you get one round sort of on the A face, and then you flip the card over and you get sort of a round on the B sides. And when you use it on B sides, then it goes in your discard, and then you cycle them all back and then have to discard one some way. Anyway, Gloomhaven Button Bugs, I do recommend it if you enjoy Gloomhaven whatsoever and you find it hard to get a group together to play. This is a great way just to go through that sort of feel by yourself.
And besides, if you're going to have a solo game, it had best be quick to set up, not occupy too much space, and a relatively quick playing time. Ideally, that's what I like out of a lot of solo games. Not always, but often. And as you said, the footprint is very marginal, even as the dials sprawl. The way I prepare a table, as it were, to set up a game of Gloomhaven Buttons and Bugs is I shove my keyboard back a few inches in my desk, and then I have enough room to set up a full game. So there you have it. I'm glad you enjoyed it. Yeah, I continue to find it delightful. Walker showed me Scrap. Scrap is designed by Kenny Michael Otten, published by Jolly Swagman Games. And I can see why Walker last week compared Scrap to Circadian's Chaos Order. Circadian's Chaos Order is a heavily asymmetric, kind of burdensome in terms of its rules grit, multiplayer area control game. And that's very much what Scrap is. My first play was almost a complete wash. It is seldom the case that in my current hobby state that I can go through an entire game of something, regardless of its weight or complexity, and not really feel like I've got a handle on what's going on by the end of the game. Usually I've got a pretty good handle by the first play. This is not a question of my being intelligent or my being particularly good at processing rules. It's I've been in this hobby for a while, and picking up rule sets is kind of like a skill like anything else, and you can pick it up after practice. So I was expecting Scrap to start making sense after second or third reset. That did not happen. There were still details that were eluding me. I had a vague sense of how to profit from things. But overall, what happens in Scrap is you're setting out these action cards in a kind of a queue, and sometimes you upgrade them by going up these tracks. But mostly you seem to get points. Here I am trying to make generalizations, and I don't feel like I have a good grasp on things. You seem to get points through combat.
The problem is that combat is attenuated through a variety of things. One of them is getting all your ducks in a row through the action programming while your opponents presumably might be trying to either get their own ducks or disrupting your ducks through their action programming. And then the fight starts, and then there's this multi-phase bidding system reminiscent of Cry Havoc or of
Rising Sun
that have follow-on effects that I couldn't immediately... Like, again, none of these things are particularly obtuse. Some of the terminology is more obtuse than it needs to be. I'd clean up some of the iconography, but mostly my criticism thus far about Scrap is as follows. I think Scrap needed an editor, a developer, somebody to chop off some of the elements and smooth down a lot of the other ones. For example, every unit on the board has two stats. You might say, oh, only two stats. How simple could that be? Well, it was the case that, again, by the end of the game, and I was paying full attention, I wasn't tired, I wasn't inebriated, I still couldn't grasp when the various stats were used. Walker was very patient, kept reminding me of which one mattered when, I just couldn't remember. And consequently, there was always just the sense of understanding being further elusive. I was like Tantalus, trying to grasp for the clever ways to go. Sometimes, you know, I started a fight once, and it was like a point pinata. I hit something with a stick, and then a glorious amount of points spewed forth. I don't really know how they got there. I don't know what they were doing there. I didn't even know why the pinata was there in the first place. I kind of know why the pinata was there. But it just, it felt like I hadn't quite internalized the systems. So where am I sitting now? Did I enjoy the experience? Mostly through the confusion. The components are very physically nice. You got these lovely meeples with printing on them, with interesting little robots, with lots of asymmetry. But again, I couldn't really grasp what the asymmetry was doing because I was just trying to come to grips with my own robot special abilities. And on top of that, I felt that some editing or some development work would have been handy because the downtime was brutal. Despite the fact that you're only doing one thing, number one, it is a thing that you planned to do two rounds ago. So whether the board state is such that it makes sense to do that, or if you remember what your overall vision was, who knows? You do that one thing, then you have to plan your next thing that you're going to be doing two rounds from now. Usually that's reasonably straightforward. And then your attention gets completely diverted over to the tracks, which... You advance on a track, which then triggers another action. Were you planning a cohesive turn involving what your planned action would do in conjunction with the action unlocked by the track? Maybe. If so, you're a smarter person than I am, or at least you're better at Scrap than I am, because I wasn't getting there. Because it just felt like this series of pointillistic removed things, and I wasn't able to get anything into a hole. Would I play Scrap again? Yes. Which... is a form of high praise because it was a solid 2 hours of confusion. So I kind of enjoyed it. And what definitely seemed to be the thing where your first play is not really going to go well in terms of processing things. And it's been a while since I've encountered that. Anyway, so this is now your... How many plays of Scrap did it make for you, Walker?
This is my second play. I enjoyed it much more this time. I really felt the area control sort of forming. And I think the points are sort of a twofold thing. I think you set up some battles to get the majority of control over the map, and then you do that harvest, which allows you to reap in a whole bunch of more points off of the map tiles. So, you know, maybe, you know, grouping those two things together or getting that to come out maybe better or worse. I think I need to utilize the tracks, like you said, the tracks more. I sort of shy away from the red side because it's
the fighty track, yeah.
Yeah, the fighty track. But I think that's just straight up points every time you do it, so I shouldn't be shying away from it.
I guess.
It's, you know, the stars.
Keep in mind, just as an indication of what I was getting at, you may think, oh, the fighty track that does fights, you're talking about starting fights? No. Because you can do damage or start a fight. And in a fight, you might do damage of various kinds. They're entirely different.
Yes, entirely different. So the fighty track lets you crush or stun. So if you just, you know, stick with the crushing, it'll get you like a small trickling of points every so often.
Is that's Walker's advice for life? Stick with the crushing?
Stick with the crushing.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
That's a t-shirt right there.
Yeah, okay. So this was a review copy sent to us by the designer. tons of interesting ideas. I think it could have done with maybe 15 to 20% fewer ideas. Like, for example, one comment I made was, I think the robots could have easily, with some redevelopment of the rules, only had one stat. And that would have simplified my experience. Like, there's a lot of stuff that could have just been chucked out. And indeed, in a lot of good games, I think they do chuck out some things that are promising. But it's a kill your darling situation, I suspect. Now, is this entirely a prejudice formed on my own part because I know that the designer is self-publishing and does not have a long pedigree? Possibly, just in terms of full disclosure. But I definitely got the sense that Scrap was about 120 pounds of game design in an 80-pound bag.
And that's Scrap.
That is Scrap.
Looking forward to playing it again, for sure.
Yeah, like I said, I'd be willing to play it again, perhaps even interested. So, yeah, I'm confused, Walker. I'm in a state of confusion. Very much like my playing of Scrap.
Just so. I got a crowdfunding game in called Biohack. This is designed by...
Yofiandi D. Indrayana, published by Uchi Bakoya.
And what it is sort of a mixture between Wingspan and Dinosaur Island. You have a player board in which you're putting different types of creatures. And when you do actions later on in the game, those creatures are going to enhance those actions in certain ways. And so, and it also has a Botoku element to it, because one half of the main board, you sort of choose, you have three workers, you choose three cards that are matching the locations of that area, and then everyone puts their pieces out. So you populate the one side of the board. And then when it is your turn, you have two choices. Either you pull back one of those workers, or if you have previously pulled back one of those workers, you can now take the workers that are back on your player board and put them out on the second half of the main board. So there are some interesting elements. I thought I was clever in the very first turn of the game, and I had something that would injure my scientist, and then I brought him back up after the placement. So I thought, oh, now I'll get to go to the second part before anybody else. But then you lose out on that whole action of the first half, which was sort of essential at the beginning. Anyway, long story short, you're getting resources on the one half at the beginning, which is mostly DNA, which brings in sort of the Dinosaur Island part of it. You're getting all this different DNA, which you're going to use to build these creatures. And there's a lot of intricate decision space. What places you want to go to first? And a lot of the places over on the second half have one-time use things, like only one person gets to go there, and then bigger worker areas, the typical, you know, small spots, bigger spots. And so the timing issues are all there. All the special abilities on the creatures are interesting. The actual creatures themselves are interesting. You start with your own unique scientist, which has powers that you can unlock. Lots of things going on. They do the one thing I like, where each phase has sort of a symbol. And some of the main actions have symbols as well. So if something has to do with that, it has that symbol with it. So it's an easy reminder. This triggers when you do that. This triggers during this phase. I love that kind of iconography. Makes the game so much easier. The game came with an A7 size sticker sheet to fix multiple cards, multiple spaces on the player boards, and spots in the rule book.
Okay.
I would rather have that than not have that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather not have any of that at all and have everything fine. But anyway, I'm glad it got fixed right off the hop. That being said, I'm very much looking forward to playing it again. I loved all the timing considerations. I love the art, which is why I got it in the first place. I love the sort of the whole theme of it, you know, bioengineering all these strange creatures.
What do you do with these strange creatures at the other end?
I can't say.
And that seems much like how Scrap does not have any transforming robots. That seems like a wasted opportunity. If the scoring mechanism were some, like, pick a major metropolitan area and destroy it with your biohacked creatures, that sounds like a lot better than just, here, have some set collection bonuses.
And so, yeah, and the scoring breaks down very much like Wingspan as well. You get blanket points for all your monsters. The bottom tier, there's three different tiers of monsters. The bottom tier monsters give you end of game scoring points. There's a bottom action on your scientist, which also, if you unlock it, victory points. And then there's the same sort of goal cards at the top.
Sure.
During the game, you're going to put out your milestones. Milestones for filling full levels of your player board. Stuff like that. Anyway, Biohack. If you have a chance to play it, I would definitely, you know, check it out. More to come.
Walker showed me Leviathan Wilds. Leviathan Wilds is a co-op game where you're trying to climb all over these eponymous leviathans, very much in the vein of the video games Shadow of the Colossus or even perhaps Dragon's Dogma. And then you have to basically destroy these crystals that are causing them to be diseased, corruption. And there are a number of very clever elements of Leviathan Wilds. Essentially, it's very much in the sort of classic pandemic vein of go and do some number of actions and then a bad thing happens. And you need to go to various spots and spend a certain number of actions to get rid of them. So the question is, can you find the necessary efficiencies? Can you avoid the bad stuff well enough? And in Leviathan Wilds, it has a number of key advantages. One of them is that it is a spiral-bound book of the different Leviathans. They're all graphically very distinct. They all have their own deck of bad cards. Granted, there's only a small number of them per Leviathan, but nonetheless, you get a completely different set. And the one we were playing the second Leviathan, and it would most of the time just strike various parts of his body in an attempt to get you off while climbing all over it. And you knew where the blow was coming, and so if you could avoid the template, then you would avoid the damage when it eventually came. I really enjoyed that part. Later on, as the threat escalated, it became more unavoidable, unmitigatable damage, which was much less enjoyable, much less interesting. I understand that the game has to have a clock, there needs to be some teeth to things, and there have to be some failure conditions, and possibly even some inexorable progress towards the failure conditions. But I found the necessarily lose one of your maximum hit points every go-round not satisfying in the slightest. It felt a little gamey and a little bit overt in terms of this is the clock.
True, but with its minimal components and its very basic gameplay, I thought it did a pretty good job.
Fair enough.
I think they leave it very open, which I love. Like the releasing and falling and the movement.
Yes, moving around the map is great. And it wasn't just a gimmick. I was afraid it was just going to be a gimmick, right? It's just, well, you're climbing all over Leviathan. Well, what does that look like? It looks an awful lot like traveling across the continental United States, which looks an awful lot like progressing along the surface of the moon, which looks an awful lot... Blah, 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 blah. But no, there's a notion of falling, gliding down is easier, going up is hard, and there are these ledges where you're safe from falling, and falling is very, very simple, and it's very easy to figure out how it works. I thought that the overall spatiality of the movement and the way that it reinforced the theme was great, and it helped Leviathan Wilds feel extraordinarily charming and very specific and cohesive, which is, I just want to stress that, because the publisher, Moon Crab Games, this is their first release, has said that they want to design, quote, fun, approachable, fully cohesive, and unforgettable tabletop gaming experiences, end quote. Cohesive, I thought, was a word that only I used with reference to board games, and I really did feel like that was evoked through the theme. It all tied together in a very, very compelling way, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of what it has to offer. Different jobs, different character abilities, different Leviathans. There's a tiny little bit of narrative, which is just the amount that I want.
For this weight, for sure.
Absolutely. I thought that it was pitched at just the right level in so many ways.
Yeah, you get to pick a character, and then you pick a occupation, and you shuffle those decks together. I don't want to give a. I don't want to pretend that there's like two cards for the character, and then a thicker deck for the occupation. But to get back, there's a bunch of anytime actions, free anytime actions, which makes the game that much more interesting, because when it's not your turn, there are some cards you can play to help your foe. To help your friends.
Wow.
To help your friends.
Wow.
There's also ways to move when it's not your turn. So like when someone triggers an enemy area attack and you happen to be in it, you can just sort of drop down and maybe hopefully not take that much damage. There's these mushrooms spread all around the Leviathans, and they just make that straight up open. You move through it, you pick it up for free. You throw it to a friend for free. You use it for free. There's none of this, you know, worrying about that kind of things. I really enjoy how just open and fun they made this nice light game.
Absolutely. So this was designed by Justin Campanian, and we decided to look him up afterwards because I vaguely remembered the name. Turns out that he's been around for a while, and he's legit. He helped co-design Condottiere, in addition to doing a whole lot of in-house redevelopment work for a variety of established publishers. I'm very, very pleased with Leviathan Wilds, and I certainly hope that Moon Crab Games, if they're able to continue putting out stuff like this, that's great. I want to play Leviathan Wilds again. I want to see the future Leviathans. You turned the page and gave me a bit of a spoiler, and it looks very different from the both cosmetically and mechanically from the Leviathan we fought. And I really appreciate how they took the theme seriously, even in a light game. It was great. That's Leviathan Wilds.
Mark was nice enough to bring wolves to the table. This is designed by Connor Alexander and put out by Coyote Crow LLC. And so they're going to have a group of games. This is like their main board game. They also have a dice game that I think is practically out already. And there's also going to be just a card game.
And this is also set in the universe of their RPG, which is called Coyote and Crow.
All three games, yeah.
Yes.
So it's very much a push-your-luck game, which I enjoy. They really boil it down to what's enjoyable. Like Quacks at Quedlinburg, sure, you can, you know, modify your bag and you do all sorts of extra stuff. But for what it is, as just a straight-up push-your-luck game, sometimes that pushes the game length too far. This is just what it seems to be. And I think on future plays, the time will be that much shorter. What it does, it is a semi-co-op game, which is odd. There are the steps or the tools that are there to make it semi-co-op are good. Like, at first we didn't understand these forest cards, but there's this timing mechanism about giving gifts, which gets you sort of prestige status for that round. And so someone that is low in status can give as many gifts as they want. This is, you know, not exactly how the rules work, but just, you know, shortly. So they're giving out a bunch of gifts and they're going up the status track. And someone who's high on the status track will not, sort of high in prestige, will not be able to give out as many gifts because people are allowed to refuse them. But what they can do is hold cards back in their hand. And people aren't sure if it's a bunch of force, which they can't play, or they might have a bunch of goods. So the timing there and being able to jump ahead of the track, there's not much of that done in our game, but I can see where you can take that semi-cooperative part of the game to the next level, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, Wolves is semi-cooperative in exactly the same way that Archipelago was, which is to say, you can all lose, or if you all win, there will be one unique winner who, in the phrasing of the rulebook, wins twice.
He's winnerer.
They're winnerer. Okay, first of all, I have no problem with the structure, but a lot of people do. Every time I played Archipelago, and indeed when I explained the victory conditions of Wolves, you get some side eye. Because despite the fact that gaming in a more traditional competitive environment, in a multiplayer game, doesn't have a strict binary, the places where it's not a strict binary, you can have different people have different evaluations, and it's all fine. Let me be more specific. So, if you're playing a traditional Euro, and you're playing with four players, people understand winning, and people understand losing. Now, granted, when you lose, you might be in second, third, or fourth place, and the value attached to those various states differ from player to player. For example, some people think that second is no better than fourth, and some people actually think that fourth, in some cases, is better than second by virtue of some weird, it's like, well, you know, I wasn't even close, so I got to play around and have fun, whatever. But the point is, the game doesn't have to have everyone be on the same page with respect to that, because everyone's on the same page with respect to I either won or I lost. In the case of this Wolves Archipelago situation, people are like, is it better to have won but not won twice? Or is it better to lose? And I can tell them, I think the game wants you to think it's better to win, but for whatever reason, a lot of people have difficulty with that. And so, unlike other games, for one, that have a more traditional victory structure that everyone's been using for a long time and thus are accustomed to, and get to be ambiguous slash agnostic as to the areas of disagreement, for the victory conditions and incentives for a game of this structure have to work, everyone has to be on the same page. I have often had difficulty getting everyone on that particular page.
I wonder if they could have done it with the wording.
Possibly.
They could have said, everybody wins, but whoever has the most of these is the leader.
Yeah, they use the term chieftain in this context. The winner is elected chief, special winner.
Ah, see, don't add that extra bit at the end.
Right? Yeah.
Just say whoever has the most of these is the chief.
I hear you. It is hard. I'm not sure any collection of words will be able to surmount this psychological barrier. I think it might be either insurmountable or only surmountable with prolonged exposure, which is not likely to happen because very few games leverage this kind of structure. So that's the first thing I'll say about Wolves. Second thing is, I really wanted to like Wolves because, number one, I like games involving gifting. So one of my favorite Euros happens to be the Tower of Babel, certainly one of my favorite underappreciated Euros. And it's all about offering people cards, and there are various incentive structures around when you want them to refuse, and when you're offering them a gift that's actually a poison pill. and elements of that structure. Very few games leverage that. Trading is pretty common, but this isn't trading. This is a question of gifting in the proper contexts, where the other element of the exchange, the pro from the quid pro quo, is not just more cards or something else. So I very much appreciate that. And number two, I really like the Coyote and Crow Company. I like the fact that it is Indigenous-led, and the team is all Indigenous people and people from First Nations, and they want to tell stories under that lens, and Wolves is no exception. I did not enjoy Wolves at all. I thought that what was amusing about Wolves was the push your luck. I agree entirely. You've got this deck of cards that's unique to you, and you want to pull as many as you can, but otherwise you bust. And that part's neat. It's got a little bit of tension, and indeed it's simple, it's straightforward, it's easy to understand. But then what that drives is I see where the intentions were. I can kind of see where the structures that they wanted to see, the play states they wanted to encourage. I did not see any of those manifest. What I saw manifest was a structure where if you drew lots of your deck, you're going to do well that round. And if you didn't draw lots of your deck, you're not going to do well that round. And if you are the prestige leader, as it is, if you happen to be leading from the previous round, then largely your responsibility is plugging up the resource shortfalls of your other players. If you're second or third or fourth or whatever, then what you can do is offer gifts that cannot be refused, which is just points bonanza. Ooh, I've got these 8 cards. Yo, leader, here, have these 8 cards. That's 16 points for me. I don't want these cards. Shut up and take them, it's leader. Good. You have to. And yeah, there's a little bit more sophistication there because once you have too many resources, you start cashing them in for prestige as well. It's a whole thing. But largely it's you want more cards. And there's a very harsh rubber banding. Oh, you're leading from last round? Well, you're just going to be the source of points from everybody else this round. Oh, you weren't leading from last round? Okay, well, you'll be able to cash your points in with maximum efficiency. And that's largely what happened.
True. I think a lot of the problems happened because we were all sort of satisfying the needs that we needed. So therefore, the first player had no leverage in order to trade. Whereas if some person had a shortfall...
Because we were playing a co-op game. Yeah. We were playing it like a co-op.
True. I'm just saying if that one person had a shortfall, you could give them this massive trade and get a bunch of points that way.
So what you're saying...
And that would... I'm not sure what the rules were for talking. Where they want the other,
you're not allowed to...
Exactly.
So there's no haggling. You don't talk about what's in your hand.
So the other players wouldn't be able to say, well, don't take that from him. I have the fish that you need. So they need a
from
fish...
them.
From them. I have the fish that they need. And so you could give them this 9... resource trade, and they would have to take it because they'd be worried that they'd have the shortfall.
Sure, and you're able to do that because you pulled a lot of cards from your deck, and they didn't pull enough cards from theirs.
No, I just true. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying in our later game states, everyone was fulfilling their needs, so no one had to trade.
Sure.
And the only trades that were happening were the forced trades.
Right.
Whereas if we had different, like you say, we had different draws, then there would have been a little bit of shortfall and the game state might have been a little bit different.
What you're observing is that the economy intends to produce a situation where you're not sufficiently confident that other people are going to be able to plug up the shortfall, and you're able to leverage that to make some interesting deals.
Just so.
And my observation is that the economy is not sophisticated enough to actually do that, and it just redounds to draw more cards, get more points.
Agreed.
Which, again, is a shame. As I say, I find the push your luck interesting, but it's kind of drowned by a surprisingly cumbersome round structure. And let me just close off by observing that I one of my metrics for determining when a round structure is too cumbersome is when people are jumping ahead. In Wolves, everyone was jumping ahead. I was trying to make sure that everyone was at the same phase of the turn, but everyone's jumping ahead because some people are just finished with the comparatively, call it busy work, call it fiddliness, whatever, and they were just moving on to the next stage. And I was just, everyone's like, no, we're on the third phase now. Let's all do the third phase, because fundamentally, Wolves is very simple. You draw your cards, you cash in you cash in some gifts, and then there's some stuff about prestige based on how much prestige and status about extra cards.
It's the same sort of thing where Distilled broke down, where there's so many phases that are so simple, everyone would be jumping all over the place, and it just broke the game down into being not enjoyable.
Yeah. I don't know if Wolves could be simplified. If anything, I think it wants to be more elaborate than it is. I think that with the economy, we're slightly more nuanced. If there was a little bit more, no pun intended, teeth to the scarcity, if we really felt under the gun, if there was a serious concern over resource scarcity that was not entirely driven by, well, all my 3 leader cards were really high up in the deck and I busted real soon for no good reason, then I think I would enjoy it a lot more, but as it is, I was left feeling that there was too much emphasis on procedural elements that were not allowing the kind of game states that I could see they wanted to generate. And that left me mostly with a feeling of frustration and disappointment.
And that is Wolves by Coyote and Crow, LLC.
Played Dungeon Fighter 2nd Edition. So a few years ago, played Dungeon Fighter 1st Edition, which is a co-op dexterity game, so already things that we're naturally predisposed to enjoy. But I remember my two plays of Dungeon Fighter mostly producing a sense of failure and pointlessness, because the way the game works is you have this bullseye, and you're trying to land dice closer to the bullseye to do damage to various monsters you encounter while dungeon crawling. And the die has to bounce slash hit the table before it hits the bullseye. So far, already a little tricky. And then you get all these modifiers, like the die has to leave your hand while you're in midair. You have to do a 360 before chucking the die.
Under the leg.
Under the leg.
Flicked off your wrist.
Flicked off your wrist, off of your forehead, off of your elbow.
Off the box lid.
Between your palms, off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Any individual one of those is potentially amusing, and then you start loading on multiple ones that facially seem impossible. So number one, you have to fudge the rules a bit. We are perfectly willing to fudge the rules for co-ops. I respect the fact that lots of other people aren't, and therefore might regard the game as unplayable on its face. So I just want to flag that, even though it's not something we personally feel. And I do remember the first edition being like, we got killed by the second monster or something. I don't know whether that's because they've really changed the modifiers for second edition, or we've just gotten better at dexterity games, because it was hard. We didn't win. We were pretty far from the boss, but we made some progress.
Yep.
You know, we encountered challenges and surmounted them. We had a sense of accomplishment. And I just want to say, the whole satire of dungeon crawling has been done a million times. I really like the art of the monsters. There was a half dragon that was a dragon with like just some random dude's upper torso smoking a pipe. And it was really well done. I thought it was very amusing. I appreciated it. And it was more goofy rather than cynical. The sort of cynical take is epitomized by Assault on Doomrock. I very much like that tone, although very seldom do I encounter a piece of artwork in Assault on Doomrock where it's like, hey, everybody take a look at this. Unless it's, of course, the accidentally included Banner of Kekistan, which you should completely remove from your copy and was included in a mistake and shouldn't be there. In the context of Dungeon Fighter, I was very much like, hey, check out this. And it was just cute art. And I enjoyed it. I thought it was really solid. We had a couple chuckles. We had some really difficult things. I will flag, though, that this is probably the least accessible game I've ever played. Not all dexterity games are going to be accessible. Some of them make an effort. Like, for example, For Science makes an effort to be accessible to people with palsy and says if you have difficulty with physical manipulation, you can stack your blocks along the table, not up from the table. Dungeon Fighter leans into it hardcore. Got some bad knees? Eh.
Yeah,
get
down on the floor, get up off the board,
exactly.
Jump around, spin around.
Yeah, exactly. Got bad knees? Forget it. Got bad eyesight? Forget it. Got one bad arm? Forget it. Yeah. Got bad one-man head? Forget it. Yeah. Missing some fingers? Forget it. Just, yeah. I mean, take your pick.
You gotta stretch that out first. You gotta prep for Dungeon Fighter.
Yeah, seldom is it the case that I can imagine all the various sundry elements. Mild arthritis, mild vision problems, slight palsy in one arm but not the other. I mean, you name it. Just... So, for a bunch of middle-aged people, we for example, immediately ruled out any card that required jumping. Because a number of people around the table had bad knees, so out. Just worth flagging. That having been said, I found it pretty charming and definitely worth playing.
Yeah, even the usual suspect of, is this a baby game for babies? He had that at first, but then, you know, came around... and said he had a very good time. So that was good.
I was surprised, actually. I did not think that Huey was enjoying himself. But it won plaudits even from Chip III, who announced that he does not normally like dexterity games.
Yeah, I played, I think when the first edition came out, I played it. This was many years ago.
Yes.
I wouldn't say many,
but it was several years ago. Back when cooperative dexterity games were very vanishingly rare.
And then, like you said, we got destroyed.
Yes.
And then had not played it once or wanted to play it once since. So I'm glad you brought it out again.
Yeah, ultimately, I think the changes are for the good. There's a lot more coherence with respect to a lot of the effects, and I thought that it was very, very difficult, but not frustrating, which is a good level. That's how I'd like my co-ops to be. So that is Dungeon Fighter 2nd Edition by Aureliano Buonfino, Lorenzo Silva, and Lorenzo Tucci Sorrentino, published by Horrible Guild in 2021, and it was a crowdfunding, so there's a billion expansions and an absurdly overproduced big box edition. We just played the retail one. So those are the games we played last week.
Some news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, I've got one piece of news. We like Mythic Battles. You like Mythic Battles.
I do.
You like Egypt. Coming up next.
Yeah.
Mythic Battles, Egypt. We'll get Egypt stuff.
Here, I don't know if I'm alone. I'm curious to hear what others think about this. When you tell me that you're designing a Greek a game about Greek gods punching each other real hard in the face, I'm like, okay. If you tell me you're designing a game about Norse gods punching each other real hard in the face, I'm like, yeah, sure. If you tell me you're designing a game about Egyptian gods punching each other real hard in the face, I'm like, really? Thoth is going to throw down with Anubis?
It's all combinable, Mark. You fight Greek gods versus Egypt gods.
Okay, Apollo is going to throw down with Thoth or Anubis?
It happened all the time. They just didn't have multimedia back then. You didn't hear about it. That's the problem.
I searched on YouTube. I could find zero clips about such an event.
Well, it's just too... It's pre-YouTube, you see.
That sounds made up.
It's probably
I'm perfectly happy to play games with Egyptian mythology as a theme, even when there's fighting involved. Somehow, this is a very personal thing, once the deities are throwing down amongst each other, in many cases, it just doesn't make as much sense to me. I don't know. That's probably just prejudice. I knew that, like, they fought. There were fights. Just, I'm not interested. What can I say?
It's true.
So it is an era of democracy in the hobby. The Golden Geek Awards up on BoardGameGeek have their voting period. The final nominees are up. You can vote until May 12th. We are still very, very grateful and flattered to have won the Golden Geek in 2020. So thank you very much again to the listeners who voted to make that possible. Additionally, the Deutsche Spielpress Awards are having their period of open voting up until the end of July 31st. You can go find them on the Spiel website to vote for the DSP Award. I still have a certain degree of enthusiasm for the DSP Award. And finally, there's a little bit of note with respect to the podcast. This is an episode ending in a multiple of five, so we will acknowledge that we have a Patreon and solicit your support. If the nonsense that we produce is of any use to you, and or you think that throwing money at us will shut us up, we would encourage you to go visit our Patreon. We have a lot of bonus content on Patreon. I just uploaded the 500th bit of audio content on the Patreon, so you'd immediately get access to all of that. Additionally, As a response to some listener requests, although I don't know if they know what they're getting into, I'm going to be producing a three-part series on philosophy. I have begun the prep work for this, so look forward to that.
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay.
Yeah, I've had a lot of trouble sleeping lately. Man, this is...
I solicited some responses from listeners asking them how many, if any, episodes on philosophy they would like, and the answer appears to be hovering around three-ish. A number of people wanted more, but three I think is a good number, and I am planning out the content for the three episodes.
The content?
Ha ha! I have heard all the Kant puns. The only one that I will endorse is the brilliant Kant pun from Hedwig and the Angry Inch. So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. Now let's take a brief break to pay some bills.
It's great that ExpressVPN protects your privacy and security online, but you can also use ExpressVPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. It's so simple, even a gibbon could do it. ExpressVPN lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. You can choose from over 100 different countries. I've been using ExpressVPN to check out Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance on South Korean Netflix, Friends and the American version of The Office on UK Netflix, Back to Canada for Sound of Metal, and luxuriating in the one and only Tim Riggins with US Netflix and Friday Night Lights. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service. Hulu, BBC iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there, but the reason I love ExpressVPN is because it is so fast and unobtrusive. It also works on all your devices. Phones, media consoles, smart TVs, and more. So if you want to get access to hundreds of new shows, use my link right now. ExpressVPN.com/SoWrongGames. And you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. That's expressvpn.com/sowronggames.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we're back. Now onto our topic, Omnibus Questions Delta Aleph. So before we get started with the questions, I just want to emphasize that we have cut some of them. This is not because necessarily we thought they weren't interesting. I cut a number of questions related to predictions about the future. Interesting ones about where the board game hobby might be going, what trends that might be coming. I have no clue. You know how some people are watching the murder mystery and like, yeah, I know who did it. I'm not that person. I'm the person both with respect to trends and with respect to entertainment. I am the guileless person who can get fooled by anything. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. I don't know what's going to happen next minute. So I don't have anything useful to say on the topic. So as a consequence, I will not be wasting your time. But thank you for those questions. Many of them are interesting. Many of them are thought-provoking. I'm like, oh, gee, I wonder. To which the answer was, I have no clue.
Just very quickly on that point. If publishers are smart, we got this glut of new people from the COVID times. I have a feeling that there will be a large content of lighter to medium games. So if you wonder why, I think this is they're trying to keep that audience. That's all I'll say.
I don't know. So let's get started, Walker. Why don't you start with the first one?
Will do. What was your most memorable gaming experience ever? Which game? Who won? What about it made it unique and thrilling?
So for me, the most memorable gaming experience I ever had was introducing people to Loop and Louis for the first time. I had never played it. I had just been reading about it for years. And I'm like, they're going to look at me sideways. They're going to give me the side eye. They're not going to trust me. And sure enough, they didn't. And then we spent 4 solid hours playing nothing but Loop and Louis. It was great. It was glorious. And a new religion was born. What about you, Walker?
Well, in 1996, Mark, one of the greatest movies, in my opinion, came out called Aliens.
Okay.
3 years later.
I don't think you're going to get much pushback from anyone. Certainly not from me.
In 1989, 3 years later, which back in those days?
99, I believe. 1989 would have been a Back to the Future situation.
1989.
Sorry. You said 96 was when Aliens came
1986.
Out. 1986. Yes. Okay. I'm on board.
1986, Aliens. 1989, 3 years later, which back then was the next day. Really?
Yep. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Nowadays, you know, we have merch before the movie comes out. Back then, 3 years later, this is something. A game called Space Hulk came out. Went to a gaming convention, saw this Space Hulk on the table, blew my mind pretty well. I was already doing, you know, Axe and Allies, which will come up later, but this was just totally something like story-driven. Mark, it's 3D role-play, don't you know?
That's what it said on the box, yeah.
And anyway, first game of Space Hulk blew my mind.
Suicide Mission, of course.
Of course.
Of course.
Actually, that's a lie.
Really?
I don't want to lie. They had set up on the board, they had the tower defense one.
Boo.
I know, but still.
I guess to show all the components or something. Yeah. The fact that 4th edition of Space Hulk does not have Suicide Mission as the first mission is a grotesque mistake. I can't believe it.
It's weird.
It's so strange. Walker, what's the dumbest thing you're smart about?
I'd say it'd be knife sharpening, Mark.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I just have this thing about it. I haven't even done it yet, but I've done so much research on
Okay,
it.
Cool.
I've looked into how many different ones there are. There's like 6 different rolling ones now
Okay. That
are like the size of no mistake, no skill sharpening.
Sure.
There's so many of the different electric band ones you can get,
right,
or pulley lever system ones. I don't know. I just have this thing. I do a lot of cooking. I do a lot of chopping.
Mm-hmm.
I am great with a re-edger, it's called. It's the steel that you bring out.
Yep.
That's not a sharpener, for those that think it is. It edges your knives. It does not sharpen your knives.
Yes.
You need an actual...
It hones, I think, is also another term.
Yeah, yeah. So you need... To need to actually sharpen your knives.
Sure.
And I have never...
I believe, Walker, we may have to get on moving. There are lots of questions here. I don't think it was explain all the things you know about the dumbest thing you're smart about.
All right, fine.
I'm very sorry. I'm interested. But you
There's
understand the...
So many sharpening methods.
Okay,
I've yet to lock them down.
What's the smartest thing you're dumb about?
I didn't have anything about this.
I am dumb about nothing.
There's
says Locker.
Many. There's so many things. I'm dumb about.
Okay, fair
I
enough.
I couldn't lock it down to one thing.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So for me, the dumbest thing I'm smart about is probably minimizing the number of times you need to cross the street. I have an elaborate system. In Kingston, I don't get to deploy it, but in Montreal, I had an elaborate system. When to cross the street and how. And the smartest thing I'm dumb about is probably Kant. I'm very dogmatic. I'm pretty dumb about Kant. Walker, when does a gyro have a soul?
When you sacrifice a chicken to it. And then you bring down... No, I think when you stop trying to win and you just sit back and you start enjoying the mechanisms and the feel of what the designer was trying to get to and watching the other players and what they're doing and just sort of watching the whole thing take place, that's when I feel that, for me, a gyro gets its soul as opposed to constantly trying to get the most out of it and just working the mechanisms themselves and just trying to, you know, win the game.
It is very telling that you focused on an individual session and the experience of playing it, whereas I naturally, and this is just an indication about how you're much more sensitive to these things than I am in a good way, and I immediately thought about the design elements. This is why we form a good balance, I think, between the two of us. And I would just like to emphasize, you used to mention something about the intention of the designer becomes apparent. And that, to me, is when a gyro has a soul, when you can tell that this is part of a cohesive vision, that the designer had a set of play states or a message or even a narrative that they wanted to convey, and you feel that it is a deliberate act. This is a deliberate cultural product and narrative rather than a disconnected series of mechanisms. So, due to a sudden influx of money in your Patreon, see, this is one of those hypotheticals that I initially read as like a news result, and I got all excited. It's an H.G. Wells kind of situation. Due to a sudden influx of money in your Patreon, you decide to become a sovereign nation. What would your flag and anthem be? So, flag, we already have one for
what
I was
about to say.
Yeah, we already have a coat of arms. It's on merch. It has our official slogan, which is "Errare audere, dare to be wrong." Very proud of it. And what, as far as anthem goes, do you have a sense of an anthem? Probably something by one of your favorite 80s or 90s bands.
I'm sure it would be like a Diana Ross sort of
ooh,
rise up.
Oh, that's great. Like that. Okay, yeah, no, there we go. Not It's Raining Men?
Probably not.
Okay. And what Macross model would use to guard your border? Well, the most effective one would no doubt be the VF-22S, I think. Because after that, they started cutting costs. The VF-22S would probably be the most effective one.
Is that the one that transforms into a scooter?
No.
No? Oh, okay.
You've talked recently about more ecologically aware. How do you do that in board games? Where do you draw the line if you're able to find one? So just another note about wolves. No plastic. A lot of people are moving away from shrink wrap. Shrink wrap is bad. You can package and ship board games without them using paper envelopes to store your components rather than plastic bags. Certainly for shipping, and reusing plastic bags for gamers where they have one. And largely, I just started taking a hugely more jaundiced eye to large miniature count board games and asking, do I really need that much petroleum byproduct? And really appreciating games that have a smaller physical footprint in general.
And I just really feel as though publishers should give you expansion choices. I really feel some expansions could be put in pouches. Not all of them.
Right.
Like you do, give us 25% in pouches, 75% in boxes. Some people like to keep their expansion separate in their own box. A lot of people just throw the expansion into the box and then that whole cardboard box for the expansion is just thrown into recycling.
Yep.
Whereas if it was just put into a paper pouch or anything,
then
that would save so much.
And stop UV coating everything. We don't need spot UV on stuff. It makes it much harder to recycle.
That's what I heard. I didn't want to say anything until I read something about it. Yes, apparently you can't recycle UV boxes.
Yeah, just stop. It's also bad from a consumer's perspective. Like, a lot of environmental stuff is also good consumer stuff. It's not always the case, but it often is. If you suddenly stopped being reviewers, since when have we been reviewers? I thought this was a drive time radio show. How would that affect the number of different games you play? We would play fewer games.
Yeah.
I mean, we're only able to have the hobby life we have by virtue of our Patreon support.
Yes.
Like, if you look back to the number of different games we played, even like in year two of doing So Very Wrong About Games, we were already successful beyond our expectations, but we had not yet started getting income from it. We just couldn't afford to go through the number of games we go through now. So there you go.
Agreed. What single game in the last 10 years do you think had the biggest positive influence on the hobby? And negative. To interpret this as you wish, whether it's expanding the hobby, introducing new concepts, being a cash, blah, 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 yeah. blah, blah, blah. I put in Scythe here, Mark.
As a good example.
No, both.
Both,
I picked a game that I think had both.
Okay, go for it.
I just think that it sort of unfortunately brought in this new genre of crowdfunding,
yeah.
be it good or bad,
mm-hmm.
but it also brought in this, you know, hybrid Euro sort of tableau building action efficiency game.
Sure. Okay, I could see that. Biggest positive influence on the hobby, I would probably say Wingspan, because this is a huge market success that really brought in a lot of gamers, a lot of people. It was a big smash hit for a woman in the industry. We don't have enough prominent women designers, unfortunately. And so regardless of what I think of the merits of the design, I think it had a marvelously positive impact on the hobby. As far as negative impact on the hobby, I would say Cards Against Humanity.
Yes.
In all the ways that Wingspan brought in new people in a good way and really showed our hobby at its best, I think Cards Against Humanity shows our hobby at its worst in a lot of ways. Look, if you like it, more power to you, but...
Yeah.
What game has had the biggest change for you, positive or negative, between the first and second play?
For me, it was... positively, it was a GNC. The first time we played it, no idea what was going on.
Oh, yeah.
Very frustrating, not enjoyable at all. The second time, where you can see what they hadn't planned, what they felt, you know, like you could sort of see the matrix, Mark. You saw it form in front of you. And you could see, I can see what you're trying to do,
yep.
but I don't jive with it. Yes. I didn't jive with it.
Right. But you could get there. It was
yes.
From... absolutely nothing to, oh, I can kind of see what the intent was, is yes, a big difference.
Exactly.
For me, the biggest change was Gloomhaven. The first time I played Gloomhaven, it's entirely my fault. I tried to play solo. I'm like, what is this garbage? I couldn't process the genius of the card flow when I was managing two separate hands. I just wasn't able to put the pieces together. I mean, I won the first scenario. I played it, and I did the thing. I'm like, whatever. And then I suggested I play it with Dr. Stallone. I'm like, I don't want to try this thing. He's like, sure. I'm like, holy crap, this is amazing.
Yeah, once the sort of the initiative is probably what brought it to light, right?
Sure.
Not seeing what the other player was going to play exactly, even though I'm going to be really fast.
For me, it's the card cycling. But yeah, the initiative definitely helps as well.
And negative for me, negative for me was Troll and Princess.
Mm.
I really wanted everything to enjoy it. I did enjoy my first game. I'm not saying it's your fault, but then you said it's like, okay, I can see this playing out exactly the same every time you play it. And then I was just sort of like, yeah, you're right. That's too bad.
Sure. How would I describe Walker's philosophical outlook? It's Walker, I think, is at his core, I think he's a sort of Humean intuitionist, for what it's worth.
This is not, I don't have any background in this.
That's fine.
So I'll just do it from how I feel.
Sure.
I feel Mark is very constant and true. And he's very proud of being a very reliable person.
Yeah, fair enough. And coming from a philosophical background where pride is a sin, I think that is all accurate.
How many hours do you get to play games in person during a typical week? Well, I have a schedule. Maybe people haven't heard. I've talked about it maybe only once. Use Google Calendar. And we have it set up. So roughly speaking, I do 10 hours a week. I have games scheduled for 5 days a week. And we usually do roughly 2 hour. That could go anywhere. But,
yeah.
You know, generically it would be 10 hours a week.
Yeah, sometimes more, sometimes less. It depends on what we need to get done. And it depends on whether there are any events that are available in the broader community. And I'm mostly the same. Some of the things that Walker has scheduled, I don't do. And I do some things that are not on Walker's schedule and vice versa. Obviously, if we only ever played games with each other, I think the content would suffer. We don't necessarily play with as many different people as we might like, ideally. But nonetheless, here we are. We've mentioned in the past wanting to encourage other group members to voice their opinions more on what they'd like to play. Are there any games if they asked you to play that we wouldn't sit down with them? Absolutely. There are tons.
Oh, yeah. Well, like inner collections. Games we have available. Would there be any games that we have available, like even if we didn't like them, we just haven't got a review copy
Games of their collection.
Or games that... Yeah, but even then, I can't think of any off the top of my head are egregious enough that I wouldn't play.
I would not play Red Dragon Inn. I would not play... there's some truly ancient stuff that Louis has kicking around that I wouldn't play. From the weird bad old days of strange CRTs and bizarre positional modifiers. I mean, there are some games that people have because we gave them because we didn't like them.
Yep.
Yeah.
I was thinking just today that I know that Louis has my copy of Mutant Chronicles, and I wouldn't mind giving it another go. I'm not even sure. I think we only played the new edition once.
Yes, which is one too many times, I think. Besides, it's not a huge problem because there's lots of games that they want to play that we would happily play as well. It's mostly just, you know, we'd like them to voice their opinions more. What is your favorite mech, Walker?
My favorite mech? Oh, clan mech. The Mad Cat.
Okay. Which is called that because it's a combination of the Marauder and the Catapult, two originally Macross-inspired mechs. So there you go.
Sure.
The Marauder being the Glaug and the Catapult. Actually, the Catapult is not really much of a within Macross inspired. So there you go. I'll give you that. That's half original.
What's your favorite Cobalt, Mark?
I've thought about it a lot. I don't know if it's the VF1 or the YF19. It's either the VF1 for Macross or the YF19 for Macross Plus. I'm not 100% sure which. I go back and forth. Do either of you have any pets? And if so, have they ever messed up a game you were playing? Walker, tell us of your pets.
I have two pets. I'm not usually a dog person. But my partner loves dogs, so we have a dog now. But we also have Potato. And Potato often attempts to join us, and sometimes we allow it when allergic people aren't there. And I have a short fuse for game interruptions, just because my time is valuable.
Yes.
And some people around the table, although most of them are pretty okay with it. And so we open up a box lid, and if he doesn't settle into the box lid, then usually he tries to sprawl across the table and destroy player boards. So at that point, he gets ejected. But usually does not destroy, has never destroyed a game state.
I am a big fan of the official swag cat, namely Potato, and the official swag dog. But I am exceptionally allergic, and I do not have any pets of my own. And yes, a Potato goes typically like a beeline to disrupt any game state if we're ever inclined to let him be in the room. So We call it sealing the airlock door and close him out. So there we go. Now that Macross is finally coming to a popular streaming service, namely Disney Plus, will we see it covered in Swag Presents Masterpiece Theater? Walker?
There is a small chance. There have been multiple times that I have downloaded Macross and attempted to absorb what is Macross.
Sure.
But now that it's more easily available on the television, because I don't watch a lot of television.
Well, the problem is that the first series won't be on Disney Plus. I actually covered this in the newsletter. It's actually more complicated than it seems, yeah. We could probably do Macross Plus. Macross Plus is 2 hours. That's an easy lift.
All right.
And it's really good, I think. What is the greatest advancement in higher quality components you've seen recently that most improves usability of games?
Well, there's been a lot of forward stuff on Bakelite tiles lately.
Mm.
And they make things a lot easier for sort of knowing what's on the board and stacking and making the game more enjoyable, handling, picking things up off the table.
Yep.
And a lot of things I've seen lately are they're doing a lot of interesting stuff with meeple screen printing, like doing multiple colors, more intricate patterns on meeples.
Absolutely.
So a lot of good stuff going on there.
I agree with the screen printed meeples, although that's mostly a cosmetic thing rather than a usability thing. For sure usability, I'd have to say it's the increasing prevalence of either dual layer boards or boards with cutouts that simulate the same effect.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Now that you say dual layer boards, my favorite. By far.
Yeah.
Even sometimes triple air boards where they have spacers.
Quadruple layer. Just keep
going. Well, I'm just saying spacers underneath.
Stack them up like cardboard.
In order for you to slide.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Games that you slide.
What game would you most like to see reprinted?
I'm very torn on this. Like, I'm usually saying any game that's good usually gets reprinted eventually.
I disagree.
I know. I know. But then I went through, I sort of thought, what could it be? I'll come up with a game. And it was Advanced Space Crusade. I have very fond memories of Advanced Space Crusade. I'd have to reread the rules because I think it's, you know, sort of like rose-colored glasses on it. But essentially, it is an old Games Workshop game where you are scouts, Space Marine scouts, versus Tyranids. And you actually go inside a large sort of living creature. So you're fighting through their stomach and their lungs and their different parts. And the doors are these orifices that open and close. And I'd have to remember how much, like if it could be a squad based where it actually works multiplayer, or was it really solely a two player game? I'd have to go back and revisit it, but maybe like an implementation of Advanced Space Crusade.
Tigers and Euphrates for me. Needs to be in print all the time.
Oh, yeah, true.
Yeah. What is the least user-friendly game out of the box that we both still really enjoy, and what got us past the issues? Well, I don't think we're going to pick the same one. But
no, because I've already talked about this game, and it's sort of fishtails back into the time it came out. Because, you know, model glue and X-Acto knives, and all of this stuff usually wasn't available to normal people.
Right.
And Space Hulk.
Well, normal people.
And Space Hulk came
Common
out.
Consumer.
Common consumer would open up the box and they'd pull out these giant sprues of what was completely unrecognizable. And you had to cut, clip, bend, twist all these things apart and then glue them together. First set that I bought, Mark, was from another country. It was, like I said, it was 1989, and it was $100. Back then, that was a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, it still is, really. I mean,
and it was just a gaming store that I called via
a telephone.
Landline.
And you sent them, I believe, some sort of mystical contract.
A check.
Yes.
My parents wrote a check for me, and we sent it out, and a game came, and I used two-part epoxy glue to glue together plastic miniatures.
Nice.
For those who know, that is sacrilegious.
It's true.
And awfully time-consuming and overkill. But anyway, yeah, so right out of the box, I think Space Hulk is rough.
Comparatively, mine is much more approachable, and that is Upfront. Upfront is very obtuse in terms of its information presentation and in terms of how to get things done, but I still adore it, and I think it's worth overcoming those conceptual hurdles.
Yeah, other games that would be brutal would be like Advanced Squad Leader and or Divine Right, where it's just so many chits that you have to punch. And
Divine Right, I'm not sure is still worth it. ASL, I'm not in a position to comment. I've been wanting to try ASL, to but even trying it is hard. You need someone to teach you is the upshot. Walker, what is your greatest success story in board gaming?
Beyond this podcast, because this podcast is a very large sense of pride for me.
That's a cop-out. I was going to say winning the Golden Geek. Yeah.
Well, that's not part of it. Just
it's not?
Not really.
No? Okay.
No, just having the vision of what we wanted to do and sticking to what plan we had.
Nah, for me, it's the external validation.
Is it? Okay.
Well, no. Because listeners went to the bother of nominating and voting for
us. I suppose,
yeah. Not just the fact that some small group of people might like it. Like, I am very gratified that the Shut Up and Sit Down wanted to invite us to Shucks. And presumably still will. Like, that's great. But it's not as meaningful personally as winning the Golden Geek for those reasons. But anyway, I cut you off.
The real one was a convention that I ran many, many years ago. Mm. We have a local military base. They used to run a convention every year. The first year students, it was sort of an assignment to them. It was like, here's an assignment. You are to run this convention. Apparently this year they got together and they said they were just going to take a fail on the assignment, and the convention was not going to happen. So I sort of picked up all of the reins of this entire convention myself and, you know, did all the work, and they came back and made last minute stuff. Everything had to be bilingual and, you know, all the stuff. So I got, you know, came together, it all happened, and everyone had fun. And so I'm sort of chuffed about it. Anyway, that's it.
If you're given effectively infinite resources to personally spend on board games and board gaming, what would you do?
It's very much like a definition. How out of the box can I go? Like, can I rent a space to play board games?
I would.
That would happen.
Yeah. No, thing. I would totally, if we could, I would buy a compound and put a number of our friends who are willing to do so on salary for them to just run it as a board gaming venue. And especially my dream of opulent wealth is just being able to pick up the phone and say, yo, set up a table for this game for me. I'm going to be there at this time in this place with these people. have it be ready, and just show up, and it's there, it's done. That to me is like infinite wealth. That is what I would do with infinite wealth.
Yes, because I'm very confined with the space that I have right now, and so just a dedicated area would be all I really want at this moment.
We've both remarked in the past that due to our jobs as game reviewers, we don't often return to past favorites. What are some of the games you'd like to go back and revisit? Any that might have fallen flat on initial play, but you think with repeated plays may have become favorites? Well, I'll just jump out and say that latter case, we're pretty good at identifying, you know, things that might reward future plays, at least as far as our tastes are concerned. Like I said, I mean, I didn't very much enjoy my playing of Scrap, but I'm intrigued, so I might come back. I think that there's more to it. The works of Christian Martinez, for example, both Inish and Galactic Renaissance, were like, oh, this is intriguing, need to play it more to figure it out. I'm not saying that we're always right after playing a game once, whether or not we're going to like it, but usually it's a little bit easier to identify what needs going back to. So we're usually good enough to be able to do that. We're able to make the time for going back to the games that we think need going back to. But what are some of the things that you think we've left behind that you really want to...
I think Evacuation, I think for us, needs another play. And then the other ones I have here are just games that we have that we both really want to play and just can't find the time, which is Turbo Kids.
Yep. I still haven't played Turbo Kids.
I know. And exactly. That's why it's here. Yep. And Jenga Maker.
Oh, yeah. Jenga Maker. Yeah. I always want to play more Battle Lore and Commands and Colors games.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah.
Two-player games.
Yeah.
So many.
A number of two-player games. Yeah. If you could have a song play for whenever you enter a room, what would it be, Walker?
Had one. Had a sort of contract job at another city.
Yeah.
And so I had a song that I played every time I came in and every time I left.
Yeah.
It is from Strelix and Alvin Risk. It's called Try It Out.
It's a Skrillex song,
oh,
really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
It's so good. Like, especially just at the very beginning. It's great for entering and leaving. It is the song.
That's wild. I've been very clear about this. If there are going to be more questions later about SwagCon, I want Kashmir by Led Zeppelin. Failing that, if we wanted to just be, like, super honest, it would probably be I Want Candy by Bow Wow Wow.
Yes, for sure.
But either one of those. Different vibes. Depends on the mood and how honest I feel like being about myself.
I honestly feel that this next question is my favorite.
Okay.
Mark, who is your favorite Muppet?
Yes, Walker? Who's your favorite Muppet?
Oh, I said Mark.
Oh, yeah.
I'm asking you. What is your favorite Muppet?
I have a soft spot for Grover. I had there's a monster at the end of this book as a very young child. I like Grover. I mean, I like many of them. Pretty much any one of the core cast members of the Muppet Show as well. But
yeah, mine is from there was a secondary sort of reiteration of the Muppet Show that came after that had like a bear, and my favorite from there is Pepe the King Prawn. Hilarious character. Check it out if you can. He's very funny. He's done a lot of like outside of the show stuff.
Sure.
You can see him doing interviews and stuff.
Pepe the King Prawn.
Yeah.
Very nice. Why did I stop playing Infinity? When I played, what faction did I play? What did I like about the game? I stopped playing Infinity because, despite the fact that I love the universe for the most part, and I love the gameplay, I love the rule set, what it does is, in order to play optimally, or indeed when played competently, very frequently it would lead to game states that were not necessarily particularly satisfying. What I mean by this, optimal play in Infinity is often grindingly attritional. And you either have the tools to deal with the tricks that your opponent has, or you don't. If you don't have the tricks to deal with your opponent's tools, then they're going to stomp you. Like, they have camo, and you can't see through camo? Well, good luck! Or vice versa. Those games are not particularly satisfying. Equally matched forces with well-done lists, you're still going to have the situation where the smart thing is to just grind down their ability to operate. And that's certainly the way that I played. That's the way I saw a lot of other people play. And I loved it, but I started feeling bad about consistently like seeing the light drain out of my opponent's eyes. Like, oh great, now I have five orders on my turn. It's like, sorry, this is the way it goes. So that's one of the reasons why I played. Also, the local scene at the time wasn't particularly active. It's more active now, but I haven't really been tempted to go back. And when I played Pan-Oceania, primarily, though not exclusively, the Neo-Terran Capitoline army, because I maintain to this day that the Auxilia are pound for pound probably the greatest single unit in the game state. And is it rules dense? Yes. Can it be learned quickly? No. I have not played Code 1. I don't know to what extent it makes things easier, because frankly, one of the ways in which Infinity is complicated is just understanding the order structure and knowing how to use the right tools and leverage the right math to overcome your opponent. So I don't know. I mean, some people seem to like it though. Some people swear that Code 1 is easier to understand, but there you have it. In terms, Walker, of the official takes we've had on the podcast, what do you think you've been the most wrong about?
I think just being too sarcastic about things, maybe. What I'm thinking about is like when I'm pretending to be hard on a game, like when we talk about Terraforming Mars or Philips Games or how I hate Spirit Island, how it's sort of off the cuff and not
sure.
not 100%, you know, and people, you know, come back and give me guff about it. And it's half off the cuff.
I have in the past been caught on been called legitimately on using irresponsible or insensitive language, and those moments still haunt me, frankly. But, you know, you correct yourself, you issue an apology, you edit episodes, and you move on. But every time it happens, I it's getting less and less frequent. Like, we try to be better, we try to be representative, we try to be inclusive. I'm not proud of it, but we correct and move on. That's all that humans can do. If you were a spirit in Spirit Island, Walker, what would your name be?
Trolls Like Brainless Toddler.
Nice. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Mine would be Uninspired Pedant Deploys Doctrine.
Nice.
Yeah. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, both good.
What's your favorite type of cuisine?
Asian for me, I think. If I don't think I could have a good curry, then I'd be sad, sad boy.
Yeah, probably Japanese for me. Almost all Japanese food. Do we have player color preferences when playing games? Walker likes purple. I like yellow. I've fallen into a trap though. A number of people I know have done the exact same thing I did. We chose yellow to associate with ourselves just for simplicity because nobody else did. So there's a non-trivial number of very hardcore hobbyist gamers who prefer yellow. And when they play with each other, they get confused real easily.
That's true. What is the best side-scroller that isn't Golden Axe related?
Golden Axe is not one, I think, of the absolute best side-scrollers. I have a great deal of affection for it. The best side-scrolling game of all time, I think, is Alien vs. Predator, the CPS2 game by Capcom. Fabulous game. Really well done in situation license and really good gameplay. But I also really, really like Streets of Rage 4. I didn't really like Streets of Rage all that much until number 4. There's tons of amazing ones, but my two favorites are probably Streets of Rage 4 and AVP. AVP is amazing. Play it if you haven't already.
What's your video game with the highest hours spent being played?
I think I know what Walker's is.
Between two.
Oh, yeah?
I just played so much WoW.
Oh.
World of Warcraft, okay. That it would be hard. But I just think that I've played so much League of Legends that it would have to be League of Legends.
Yeah, yeah. Probably for me, it's Destiny. I used to play Destiny. That's in terms of sheer hours. In terms of non-online games, it's probably Risk of Rain. I've played so much Risk of Rain, Walker.
So much.
So much.
And well, with video games nowadays, I can't do it with League, but you can go on Steam and it'll tell you how many hours you played.
I know.
Some of mine can't be true. You look at Civ though, right?
Yeah.
You'd be kind of scared to see how many hours you spent playing
Civ. I have played zero Sid Meier's Civilization games, so I wouldn't know. I don't say this is a point of pride. I just haven't.
No, yeah.
And what about board games? Do you think you could figure out the board game put in those hours?
I was thinking about it. We play so many, but back in the day, there was Axe and Allies.
Sure.
Back in high school days, we would take weeks off of school. At least the first week.
Weeks off of school?
Yeah, 1 week. We took 1 week off of school. It was the first week that I introduced it to my closest friends.
I see.
And they didn't want to go to school for a week. We played Axe and Allies for a week straight.
Wow.
And then we played Axe and Allies for a month straight.
My goodness. Then
we never played Axe and Allies again.
For me, it's probably Infinity. I've played Infinity over 100 times, and, you know, a couple hours of whack, that's probably going to do it. What's the most controversial opinion you're willing to state on the podcast?
This might cancel me, Mark.
Well, but you're willing to state.
Oh, I'm willing to state.
This is asking us to dance close to the line.
It's good because as the opinion in the game, believe it or not, Mark, people can have different opinions than,
it's
than
true.
You.
That's fair.
I think it is a point of reflection that people need to think of, that it is okay for people to have different opinions.
Yeah, but the corollary to that, the false inference from that is that it is okay for people to have any opinion, which I don't think is true.
Correct.
Anyway, I've stated on the podcast before that I'm an anti-war pacifist. I think that, and that gets people real mad. What's my elevator pitch for why people should read Kant? That's because I think Kant discovered the truth, capital T, about a number of things, such as the nature of human perception and the nature of human thought in a number of ways, and also with respect to the formulation of the moral law.
I think I would struggle a lot with calling my friends by their name in person and an alias while you're speaking on the show without slipping up. Is this tough? Do you call them by their aliases in real life?
No, never. No. I've never called someone by their alias, and I've only ever once slipped up on air and then had to edit out referring to somebody by their real name instead of their alias. This started... I value confidentiality a great deal, far more than a lot of my peers when I was studying medical ethics. And rather than getting people's permission every time I wanted to talk about them, we started referring to people in the generic as Huey, Dewey, and Louie. This was Walker's innovation. Eventually, this solidified so that we had a specific Huey, a specific Dewey, and two specific Louies. One is Louie with an S, one is Louie with an E. This is a differentiation in my head that not many people know. Walker, I think, only confusion is there's been a persistent misunderstanding as to which is Huey and which is Dewey.
It just doesn't matter. Like, it's,
I know. That's what I think.
It's one of these things that we just do so we don't use their real names. Yeah. I don't understand why it matters
name
I use.
It matters to me for no good reason.
Gotcha.
I like the world building. I like the notion that there's this expanded casts. But it's actually been shockingly easy.
What were the best, most memorable, and worst, most forgettable games you guys played that were based on a movie or TV IP?
My least favorite game based on an IP is sincerely Battlestar Galactica, movie or television. I genuinely do not enjoy that game.
Yeah, Battlestar Galactica is bad.
My favorite
but it's
is...
so bad it's not forgettable.
It's true. the most forgettable, I think, is probably the Princess Bride adventure book game, which was so bland and forgettable. It wasn't quite offensive bland for whatever reason. It was just generic. Anyway.
I'm trying to remember. There was like sort of a reskinning of a game based on that TV show about the terrorist.
Oh, Homeland.
Homeland, that's it.
Homeland is very good.
Yes.
I quite like Homeland. Probably my favorite movie or television IP game is... Oh, jeez.
It was the original Aliens game, which was fantastic.
It'd probably be the original Aliens game. Yeah. Yeah. Just in terms of... Yeah.
Just for the feel. They really did a great job of sort of... I'm not saying it was a great game.
Yeah.
I'm saying they did a great job of encapsulating
what
the movie,
yeah,
was, the tension of the movie, the feel of all the different acts of the movie,
yep,
were all sort of played out in this one sort of
absolutely
game. There was also a very really good Empire Strikes Back movie, the Attack on Hoth.
Game, you mean.
Game, sorry. Yes,
the Empire Strikes Back movie was called Empire Strikes Back.
Thank you.
It is widely regarded as
I think
being quite excellent.
I think it's a Starry Wars movie. Yeah,
yeah, I think it's one of the Trekkie ones. I think.
Was it?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah, yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Walker, what's your favorite anime?
I don't... Akira, I think.
Okay.
Like, you and I both watch up-to-date anime, like the week it comes out,
me
right?
A little bit... No, I do not.
Okay, well, some... Not... Okay.
Recent, within the year.
Within the
year.
We, you know, keep up-to-date. And there hasn't... There hasn't been one lately. Parasite was fantastic, I thought. But other than that, there haven't been very many ones that have super stood out to me as great.
Sure.
There was Death Note, which I really loved.
Yeah, I didn't really like that.
And, yeah.
A lot of people do. My favorite is Cowboy Bebop. Hardly shocking. Probably close second is the first season of The Melancholy of Suzume Haruhi, only if watched in the broadcast order, not the chronological order. Presented out of order, the series is fantastic. Presented in order, the series is uneven. Favorite single-player video games? Star Control 2.
I don't... Slay the Spire. I think if you looked at my hours played...
Oh, there we go.
I really don't normally do single-player games.
Sure.
So, yeah.
All right. There's a whole bunch of questions about retro emulation. I have one about what is your ideal retro emulator personal portfolio? Well, it's the one that I have. What you need is a handheld PC. I think my current favorite one is the GPD WinNex 2, which is overkill, and I cannot recommend anyone buy it, but I love it to bits. I do not like the Steam Deck. Then you need a powerful Android device, which is the Odin 2, which is overkill, and I cannot recommend anyone buy, but it is a wonderful device. And then you need some kind of mid-range thing. And let me tell you, mid-range for $50-ish, it is a golden boom era. All right. Here's the deal. You've got your Miniu Mini Plus, great device. You've got the Embernic R35XX Plus and 35XXH. Both of those are great devices. Also, the TrimUI Smart Pro. Take a look at those. See which one you like. Based on the look of them, maybe watch a review or two. They're all about $50. There's a lot of sales now on AliExpress. Don't fear AliExpress. It's like eBay. You just have to know to trust your seller. There you go.
You find your...
This is an interesting question.
You find yourself magically inserted into a board game as a character. Of all the games in which the Swag Cannon personal and annual top tens, which one would be the worst character and which one would be the best? Feels though Hansa Teutonica would be the worst. You're walking along a road. Someone boots you into the ditch. You're like in your house. Someone, you know, knocks you out the window and now you're homeless living outside the house. I think that would be, yeah, that's a bad game to be in.
For me, it's Assault on Doomrock. That place looks unpleasant.
I would love to. The best, I think I would totally be in Death would be the best one. Isn't that what it's called? Cthulhu. Oh, die.
Cthulhu,
sorry,
die.
Yeah, that one.
Ooh, that would also be really bad. Ooh.
No, good.
Why?
It's something different all the time, man. You turn around the corner. You go around a corner in those towns, you have
about.============            �└└└└└+=
you have no idía
what
you're
going to see. That's absurd.
It would be amazing.
As for best, I really... I don't know. I'm not one of those people who like fantasizes about being different places in different times. I just... they all seem really bad. Like, I just only see the downside to going to any of those. Like, antiquity sounds like a bad scene. I don't want to be in antiquity. So that rules out anything. Maybe Infinity? I don't know. I would. the universe of Infinity, if the humans manage to fight off the aliens, it seems like a good place. You can be immortal.
Yeah.
But the good kind of immortal with your consciousness. It seems like they've got a number of things figured out, at least in Panoceania. Maybe Hakaslam? I don't know. Maybe. So that is going to wrap up this round of questions. There are many more that we have to address, many more truths to establish, many more controversies to settle, many more bits of illumination to share with you, the wonderful audience. Thank you for your questions, and we appreciate your participation in this little experiment a great deal, but that's going to do it for this week for So Very Wrong About Games.
Hope you found it fun. Hope you found it interesting.
You better, because there's going to be more! If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find all our relevant information at sowronggames.com. We read everything you send us, so we'll get back to you if we can. Thanks again for deciding to spend some time with us. We appreciate it a great deal. Please do take care.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bigney. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soveryronaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter at sowronggames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.